I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. It was a big week last week for Supreme Court watchers, and a surprising one, too. On Monday, the court ruled 6-3 that gay, lesbian, and transgender employees are protected from discrimination by the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Conservative Justice Neil Gorsuch wrote the opinion, with Chief Justice John Roberts joining the liberals on the court. Then on Thursday, the court told the Trump administration that it could not put an end to the DACA program, which has protected some 700,000 immigrants brought to the U.S. illegally when they were children from deportation. John Roberts wrote the 5-4 opinion and told the Trump administration to come up with a better justification if it wanted to dismantle DACA. There are some other decisions in the court pipeline, which we'll hear about in the next few days, the next few weeks, in which we will talk about with our guests, and they include contraception, abortion, the Electoral College, the president's taxes, and federal Indian law. Let me introduce our two guests. Jeffrey Rosen is the president and CEO of the National Constitution Center. Jeffrey, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Wonderful to be back.
And also with us is Maggie Blackhawk. She's an assistant professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania School of Law. And Maggie Blackhawk, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, you can contact us with any questions or comments, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You can always call us at 1-888-477-9499. And we have a lot to cover during this hour. Jeffrey, let me begin with, can we still say the Robert Courts is considered a conservative court after last week's opinions?
We can indeed. Many of its decisions will be conservative in the weeks coming up, and there's no change in the broad balance of the court. But what we can say after this week is that this is a court governed more by constitutional methodology than by politics. And that's an inspiring and affirming message. It was wonderful to see Justice Gorsuch faithfully applying his principles as a textualist to reach a result that he may not have embraced on policy grounds. And similarly, to see Chief Justice Roberts caring about the institutional legitimacy of the court, and just as he did in the census case last year, insisting that the president had to follow fair administrative procedures before changing a policy. Mostly what we saw this week is this is the Roberts court. Chief Justice Roberts cares a lot about avoiding 5-4 splits, Republicans against Democrats. He thinks that's bad for the institutional legitimacy of the court in a polarized times. And he's doing everything he can, and quite successfully this week, to avoid that and to create bipartisan coalitions of liberal and conservative justices who can converge around a common result.
And I do want to talk about some of those really important decisions. Maggie, let me get you in on the conversation. How do you see the court, and specifically, how do you see Chief Justice John Roberts?
Roberts has been praised as an institutionalist, someone who values the legitimacy of the court, but he's also seen as an incrementalist conservative, so I'm not quite sure if we can move away from the conservative frame of the court quite yet, and you can see that even in the DACA opinion, because the 5-4 opinion rested on the APA and not on the Equal Protection Clause claim, which the majority of the court, 8 justices, signed on, essentially raising the bar to bring an Equal Protection Clause claim in that case. And so it was give with one hand, take away with the other, which is what Roberts is really known for. He did that with the ACA in the past in the Commerce Clause. And so it's a bit of a conservative, with a little C, big C conservative move by the court where it looks like an opinion that is free of politics, but in reality, it actually sets the stage in the future for a very conservative bend on our Equal Protection Clause doctrine.
Jeffrey, let me go back to you. And Maggie, we're going to try to get you on a better phone line, but let me go back to you, quoting Justice Roberts. This was in 2018, Jeffrey. He said, we don't have Obama judges, we don't have Trump judges, we don't have Bush judges, we don't have Clinton judges. Is that true? And what does that tell us about his view of the court and, I guess, his role in it?
It's a profoundly revealing quotation from Chief Justice Roberts. And it tells us that that's what he believes. He believes it to the core of his being. He thinks that judges should not be Republican or Democratic, but should be judges. I had an extraordinary opportunity to interview him during his first year as Chief Justice. And he said a version of the same thing. He said, this is such a polarized time. This is back, you know, in 2006, with the president and Congress at each other's throats. It's so important for citizens to see the courts as something beyond partisan politics. He pointed to the words above the Supreme Court, equal justice under law. And he said that citizens should see the courts as embodiments of that nonpartisan ideal. And he's really made it his mission as chief to avoid the perception of Obama and Trump, or Republican and Democratic justices. That helps explain his vote in the health care case, where he didn't want to strike down that law on 5-4 grounds. It explains his decisions this week. And it's an ideal, which is an inspiring one. The court doesn't always achieve it. There are indeed 5-4 splits. As Maggie says, there are partisan divides on the court. No one would divide that. But Chief Justice Roberts is trying to rise above them. And the fact that he was so successful in doing it this week is really to his credit.
Well, let's talk about the ruling having to do with LGBTQ employees and Gorsuch. Interestingly, Jeffrey, Gorsuch wrote the opinion, and talk about words. It seemed to, in my reading, such as it is, of his ruling, is that, and he is a textualist, but that these words, like the word sex in the 1964 Civil Rights Act, seem to mean something very specific to him.
It's an amazing decision. It's so, I hope listeners will read both the majority opinion and the dissents, because it's a vision of at least two different visions of textualism. Chief Justice Gorsuch says that we should read the words as they were originally written, but as they would apply today. So he says the word sex meant what it meant in 1964 as it means today. But he says it's just literally true that if you fire an employee because he or she is gay, you're treating him or her differently than you would if that employee were a member of the opposite sex. So therefore, it is a literal form of sex discrimination. Now, the dissenters, led both by Justice Alito and Justice Kavanaugh, said, we're textualists too, but we think you should read the word in context. What would it have meant when it was written? And in 1964, both of those justices said, no one would have thought that the word sex include discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or transgender status. So it's a kind of intramural dispute of interpretive methodology among the conservatives. Both had very powerful arguments. Both were consistent with what they'd said before. And that's why it's such a really wonderful example of how often the justices are moved more by methodology than by politics.
Meg, we have you back, and let me just quote from Gorsuch from the opinion. He said, and I'm quoting here, an employer who fires an individual for being homosexual or transgender fires that person for traits or actions it would not have questioned in members of a different sex. Sex plays a necessary and undisguisable role in the decision, exactly what Title VII forbids. And Jeffrey was talking about this textualist interpretation of, of the law and the Constitution.
Yes, Justice Gorsuch approaches the text of Title VII looking very closely at because of sex and what that meant at the time that it was drafted, which meant, you know, biological sex, whether or not you are a woman or a man. And so a woman with children, for instance, small children, would have a harder time getting a job than a man with small children. That's discrimination on the basis of sex, just like a man who is attracted to men would have a harder time getting a job. And so he reads it in what Justice Kavanaugh accuses him of as a literalist interpretation. But if you look really closely at what both Justice Alito and Kavanaugh describe in their dissent, they're looking for the norms of the time to be codified into the text of that statute. And Justice Gorsuch waves that away and says, no, we don't actually codify the norms and the morals and the values of the time in the text. They just meant biological sex. And if you discriminate on the basis of biological sex, then you're going to end up violating Title VII. So it is, in some ways, it's a methodological dispute between the two sets of justices. But at the same time, it's also a question about when do morals and norms come in to the Constitution, and how do they come in, and whether or not they're codified in the statute in 1964, or if they move with the times based on the meaning of the text.
Well, and picking up on that, I mean, Jeffrey, like gay marriage, I mean, public opinion has really moved dramatically on this particular issue about workplace protections.
It very much has. And it's striking about how widespread the support for anti-discrimination protections for LGBTQ people are. But the justices disagreed about whether that should matter. The dissenter said, look, Congress has several times considered the possibility of adding sexual orientation and transgender status to Title VII protections. It's refused to do so. Therefore, we, the court, shouldn't step in and do it for them. Mm-hmm. And Justice Gorsuch says it doesn't matter what Congress has done, and it doesn't even matter what public opinion says today. All that matters is what a literal meaning of the text means to an ordinary observer. It was a really interesting clash between the conservatives who think you should just follow the text regardless of the context or the original meaning or the current meaning, and the more literalist Justice Gorsuch, who says we have to read the words according to their natural meaning and let the heavens fall. Completely fascinating.
Absolutely. And Maggie, just one more question about this. Were you surprised by how Gorsuch framed his argument?
I wasn't, and that was because Justice Gorsuch has taken this approach in at least oral arguments in earlier cases this term, one particularly dealing with federal Indian law and the status of an Indian reservation in Oklahoma, McGirt v. Oklahoma, which is still pending before the court. And there you saw the exact same split, with Justice Gorsuch wanting formalism, wanting to apply the law as written in the text, and you see Kavanaugh and Alito deviating from the way the law is written in order to apply their, whatever they think their norms or values or the best approach to the law should be. And Gorsuch just sticks to his formalist guns and the textualist guns. He is, you know, probably more committed to his interpretive methodology at this point than Justice Thomas. And maybe even Justice Scalia, even though Justice Kavanaugh really takes Gorsuch to task for that. But it seems like this might be a common split among the court, given the fact that Justice Gorsuch really is moving away from putting his own moral norms in his interpretive methodology, which I think is true to form. I mean, that is, you know, in some ways more true to adhering to the text than if you put your own moral values in, because otherwise what you see is Kavanaugh and Alito just trying to have a throwback to the moral norms of an earlier day, which is trying not to stick to the text and the law, but to stick to those old values, which is a very different approach to the Constitution, to the text of statutes, and to separation of powers.
And fascinating. Let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. That's Maggie Blackhawk. She's an assistant professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania School of Law. Jeffrey Rosen, president and CEO of the National Constitution Center, talking about the U.S. Supreme Court, some of their fascinating decisions of last week. There are some other decisions, frankly, in the court pipeline, which we will talk about as well. Do stay with us. Much more after this short break.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and if you're just joining us, I'm talking with the National Constitution Center's Jeffrey Rosen, the University of Pennsylvania Law School's Maggie Blackhawk, about some really fascinating Supreme Court decisions of last week. We'll be talking also about some of the decisions that we'll hear about in the next few days, next few weeks. Jeffrey, let me go back to you, and let's talk a bit about the DACA decision made by the court. It was written by Chief Justice John Roberts. What was he telling the Trump administration?
He was telling the Trump administration precisely the same thing that he told the Trump administration in the census case last year, which is that when you try to change administrative policies by executive order, you need to go through proper procedures, and you can't give fake reasons. That was the core of the decision. The administration said the reason that we wanted to repeal DACA, which the Obama administration had imposed by executive order, is because we thought the policy was illegal. But Chief Justice Roberts said when you issued that letter saying that the policy was illegal, we don't think that was the real reason you changed the policy. We think there were other reasons. And we also think that you didn't do what the statute requires, which is to balance your views about the merits of the law against the harms to the DACA beneficiaries, including the 200,000 people who would have to be deported, the costs to their families, and the statute requires that balancing of costs and benefits. So Chief Justice Roberts said, you came up with another reason later that was a little more complicated, but you can't come up with post hoc reasons. We're going to judge your policy based on the reasons you give when you actually handed down the policy, and this reason just won't cut it. So he said, go back to the drawing board. If you want to repeal this policy, you have to go through proper notice and comment procedures. You have to weigh costs and benefits, and you have to give us a real reason. If you do that, we'll take another look. But at the moment, we're not going to approve this. It's just what he did in saying that the Secretary Wilbur Ross couldn't take the citizenship question on the census without proper procedures. And it shows Chief Justice Roberts' commitment to regular administrative procedures when it comes to administrative law.
Now, Maggie, my understanding is that any president has, or in this case, the President Trump has the power to end the DACA program, I guess the way President Obama was able to create it. Is there a legitimate reason for ending DACA you think that would be appealing to this court?
There may be, but the reasons are procedural. So the decision, the DACA decision, rested on the procedures that the Trump administration went through to repeal the DACA. And the court explicitly discounted in Part 4 the idea that DACA was rescinded in this case because the Trump administration was racially discriminatory or discriminatory based on national origin. They rejected that. And so those, you know, even all of the statements made by the Trump administration in advance about the Latinx community couldn't meet the standard. And so the reasons were actually brushed to the side. And you see in Justice Sotomayor's dissent and partial concurrence is, you know, the feeling that there is no possible reason. It's basically the Trump administration can discriminate racially and in the context of national origin as long as they follow proper procedures, which is actually a pretty narrow, it is a win, but it's a narrow win. And it's one that we should be cautious of because the reasons should matter. Those statements made by the administration should matter. And we saw this earlier in Trump v. Hawaii, where we had the travel ban upheld despite the fact that the Trump administration had been very clear that this was a religious discrimination. This was based on national origin against Muslims, the Muslim community. And so I think that there is, you know, a caution to seeing the opinion as a complete win, even though on its face, like the upholding of the Affordable Care Act and Obamacare, it looks like a win in the short term. There really is some problems with the opinion in the long term. You had eight justices signing on saying, we don't really care about this discriminatory reason. They can discriminate. The bar is very high as long as their procedures are fine getting to that decision.
A procedural decision. Jeffrey, let me read something that Kate said about this particular case. She says, where's the common sense in all this? These children were brought here by their parents. They've been living in the United States cities, educated in U.S. schools. They are Americans, she says. And part of DACA is you need to, you know, get through certainly high school, maybe even into college. If you serve in the military, I mean, there are certain requirements that these largely now adults, but they were brought here as children, they have to meet certain requirements in order to meet the requirements of the DACA program.
That's exactly right. Justice Sotomayor did stress that. But as Maggie said properly, the majority of the court did not take those policy considerations into account. They, as Maggie pointed out, were not moved by the discriminatory statements. They didn't think that it was relevant about whether or not there'd be serious harms, except to the degree that the administration failed to consider them. So Chief Justice Roberts has just about one or two paragraphs about those possible harms on the recipients. And he says, as Maggie suggested, yes, the administration can end the program, but at least it has to weigh those harms. Well, we're not going to say which way the balance should strike, but it has to consider them by applying proper procedures. So in that sense, there was, and Maggie is absolutely right to point this out, an important division between the more liberal justices who joined Justice Sotomayor and would have taken those harms into account, and particularly the discriminatory animus, and those justices who said all that matters is the proper procedures.
Here's an interesting tweet from Stephen. He says, I don't buy that the dissent by the conservatives about sex, he says, is textualist. If you applied this to the Second Amendment, would the conservative justices advocate an interpretation in which only single bullet muskets were allowed to be kept by militia members? I mean, this takes us into a whole other issue, and perhaps the Heller decision, but also about the Second Amendment. Do you have a quick response to that, Maggie? Because I do want to talk about some other cases.
You know, I think Stephen's tweet is exactly right. So the dispute over what original public meaning is in the context of textualism, there are a lot of moving parts there. Yeah. And it's interesting to see when will let meaning move, you know, muskets to handguns, for example, and sex, biological sex to biological sex. But if you look at the actual opinion in Bostock, the LGBTQ opinion, Gorsuch is very quick to adhere to the idea that biological sex was the meaning in 1964, and it's still the meaning today. And so the discrimination narrative that he conjects around the sex is one where the meaning isn't actually moving. But he's also saying it's not based on the moral norms, where if you look at Justice Alito and Justice Kavanaugh's approach to the text in their dissents, they want the norms of the time, not just muskets, but actually the feelings around guns to be codified within the text, which it's a really strange approach to what text means, to think that all of the moral norms of the time get codified into one word or even a phrase or a sentence. And so his comment is exactly on point, but to take it even a step further, they're looking for morals rather than just meaning.
That's interesting. I would like to follow up that on a different show, possibly. Again, that's Maggie Blackhawk. She's an assistant professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania School of Law. Jeffrey Rosen with us as well. He's the president and CEO of the National Constitution Center, talking about what the Supreme Court has been deciding over the last couple of weeks and some other decisions, which we might hear some this week, next week, and maybe even into early July. And again, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get to a couple of more cases before we have to say goodbye to you. Jeffrey, let me go back to you. In May, the court heard several arguments about President Trump's tax returns, a case from the Manhattan District Attorney and also from some House committees that I believe issued a subpoena for his taxes. What should we know about this while the court is either making its decision or while we await their decision?
Well, they're very important cases, obviously, and both involve the standards that should apply to a president when Congress or a prosecutor are seeking information from him. Those who are against the administration say the ordinary standards should apply. As long as there's no claim of executive privilege or specially confidential information, then Congress or a prosecutor should be able to get the information if it's relevant to an ongoing investigation. The president at one point came up to the brink of saying, you should never be able to get information from me while I'm president. That's a hard case to make, since Thomas Jefferson had to turn over information by subpoena on the order of Chief Justice Marshall. So the more modest claim that the administration made in the arguments is a slightly higher standard should apply. You should have to show special need for the information when the president is involved. And then when it comes to a prosecutor, the standard they said should be even higher, because you don't want any state prosecutor to be able to call the president into court for any reason. It really was hard to read the court. I wouldn't venture to predict to predict that one. The lower court had been bipartisan in saying that previous presidents have had to turn over information going back to President Nixon, who wasn't able to resist turning over the Watergate tapes. The justices asked questions from all over the place. So all we can know from this week is that Chief Justice Roberts will want to seek some kind of middle ground that could bring in liberal and conservative justices that might involve making up some kind of compromise standard or perhaps making the president turn over the material. But as they say, we'll see. And it's going to be very important because it'll determine whether or not the president's tax returns will be turned over or not.
Yeah, we will follow up on that. Maggie, let me go back to you on something that you raised earlier. This is a case called McGurk v. Oklahoma, and it hasn't gotten quite the attention, I think, that some of these other cases have. It involves eastern Oklahoma. It involves, you know, what sounds like a jurisdictional dispute. What's at stake here?
So the McGurk v. Oklahoma decision will decide whether or not the Muscogee Creek Reservation extends over huge swaths of eastern Oklahoma, or whether or not Congress has, over time, diminished the reservation through breaking of treaties, by breaking the law that is established, by trying to essentially destabilize the Muscogee Creek Nation, by destroying its government, by prohibiting, actually criminalizing its government structure, and whether or not now, because of all those things that Congress has done in the past, the state government of Oklahoma or the federal government has jurisdiction over certain crimes that are committed within eastern Oklahoma. And it is actually a capital case. And so what you have is, in many cases, the lives of certain people are on the line, whether or not the state had jurisdiction over their crimes to begin with, whether or not they should be on death row. Because if the federal government has jurisdiction, then you vacate their sentence, and they may not be on death row in the future. And it has huge implications for federal Indian law. And, you know, the future of what American colonialism looks like with respect to Native people, because the case itself could set a rule, at least listening to oral argument and Justice Kavanaugh and Justice Alito, not Justice Gorsuch, who is great on federal Indian law, but listening to the conservative wing of the court, they want to abandon the law as established, the rules as established by the Supreme Court, to create a standard that essentially makes it very easy for the court to decide whether or not there should be federal jurisdiction or whether or not Native nations should be able to wield power, especially over the city of Tulsa, because the case will decide who has jurisdiction over the city of Tulsa in Oklahoma, which is a big decision.
Absolutely.
But it also means that the community might lose control, Native people might lose control over their own criminal jurisdiction, their own policing, a huge.
Sorry to do that. I appreciate that. And it's something absolutely to keep an eye on. Jeffy, let me go back to you. And again, just watching the clock here, we just have a couple of more minutes. And I do want to talk about June Medical Services v. Russo. This is an abortion case involving a Louisiana law that requires abortion doctors have admitting privileges at a local hospital. Seems very similar to the Hellerstedt decision that came from Texas back in 2016. What's at issue for this court? In this case?
Well, you're absolutely right. It is very similar to the 2016 Hellerstedt decision. In fact, the liberal justices say it's essentially the same case. So really what's at stake is, will the more conservative justices, joined for the first time by Justice Kavanaugh, who's replaced Justice Kennedy, will they overturn the Hellerstedt decision and say that it's okay to require admitting privileges, which would dramatically reduce the availability of clinics in states like Texas and around the country? Will they distinguish it on very legalistic grounds and say you can have these admitting privileges sometimes but not other times, which would really invite even more restrictions, including that like Tennessee from a couple of weeks ago, which tried to ban abortions as of 6 weeks of pregnancy, which was kind of an open challenge to Roe v. Wade? or will five justices at least affirm Hellerstadt clearly and say, regardless of what we may have thought of it as an original matter, it's now a precedent? Any of those results would be very relevant in telling us about the future of Roe, and that's why the decision is so important.
And my understanding with Hellerstadt is that it ruled that this put an undue burden on women by forcing doctors to have admitting privileges. Do I have that right, Jeffrey?
That's exactly right. And in practice, it meant that there were almost no clinics in certain states, which made it impossible for women to exercise their constitutional right to receive abortions.
Maggie, there are more cases, but let me just ask you about the next president, whether it's going to be President Trump or, I guess, President Biden. It seems like those are the two contenders. It seems that Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who I believe is 87, has indicated that she wants to retire. Seems like she is holding on during the Trump administration. Just how many judges or justices do you think the next president will get to appoint or suggest?
You know, it's really hard to say. I mean, at least two, because you do have Justice Thomas and Justice Ginsburg. But I think the interesting point is that Justice Gorsuch is unexpected. And so although we tend to, you know, conflate politics with the court, those unexpected appointments did happen. And it's important to recognize them when they do and to not put all of our weight onto which administration put a particular justice on the court.
Kind of quoting Chief Justice Roberts. Well, we have to leave it there. Jeffrey Rosen, as always, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. He's the president and CEO of the National Constitution Center. And Maggie Blackhawk, thank you for joining us as well on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. And she's an assistant professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania School of Law. We've got State Representative Brian Sims waiting in the wings, and we will be talking more about the court's historic ruling on LGBTQ rights. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, and as I said, Pennsylvania Representative Brian Sims now joins us. He's the first openly gay member of the General Assembly. We're going to be talking about the significance of the Supreme Court's historic 6-3 ruling on LGBTQ rights, how it will impact LGBTQ people in Pennsylvania, and some of the continuing efforts to pass a more comprehensive anti-discrimination law in the state of Pennsylvania. And Brian Sims, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. Do we have Brian? I hear nothing. Let me just give out the ways that you can join our conversation. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can always tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can pick up the phone and give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Brian, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. So what does this mean for the Commonwealth's, what, 500,000 LGBTQ residents, what the Supreme Court ruled last week?
Well, it does mean exactly what the Supreme Court ruled. It does mean that those of us that are LGBTQ in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania now have some protections in the LGBT civil rights sphere. We have those protections with regard to employment. But, of course, we're still lacking protections in areas of housing, public accommodations, things like universities and hospitals. And I think that's one of the salient points here. I'm extremely excited about this ruling, no question. But it does highlight how far from full equality LGBTQ Pennsylvanians actually are.
I asked our previous guest this question, but I'll ask you as well. Were you surprised that it was Gorsuch that wrote the opinion and that Chief Justice John Roberts joined with the liberals?
I was more surprised to see that it was Gorsuch and that he wrote the opinion that I was to see Chief Justice Roberts side with the majority. I think in reviewing the opinion, it's clear that they are looking at the sort of the body politique, as it were, that surrounds civil rights in Pennsylvania or in the United States. And it's grown increasingly difficult if you look at a sort of contemporary American view of civil rights to exclude LGBTQ people. And so I'm extremely pleased that they joined the majority and that they wrote for the majority, because I think that gives us an indication if when we see perhaps a Supreme Court decision about housing or about public accommodations that we can expect the same sort of decision making from these otherwise conservative justices.
Does this apply then to all places of employment in Pennsylvania?
So the quick answer is, as a lawyer and as a legislator, it's actually kind of complicated. And the answer is, we don't know. And it's not that we don't know, because we kind of can't know yet. There are still going to be cases of discrimination in Pennsylvania. There are still going to be cases where people have to bring claims against employers. Arguably, yes, it does. But when with respect to issues, for example, about religious institutions, no, it's not likely to cover them. And so there is still a body of law that will have to grow from this decision, as most Supreme Court decisions do. But the quick answer is, we don't know and we can't know yet.
Well, it is interesting, and Pennsylvania has had a law essentially saying that you could be fired if you were gay or lesbian or transgender, something like 50 municipalities have laws protecting LGBTQ workers from this kind of discrimination. So it's an interesting sort of mix of laws competing with laws in the Commonwealth.
It's sort of the Wild West. And if you know anything about sort of American jurisprudence, part of the reason we have the stratified court system that we have is to ensure that something like that doesn't happen. I'm often remind people that in my two-hour drive to work from Philadelphia to Harrisburg, that I drive in and out of areas where I am fully protected as an equal citizen in the Commonwealth that I represent four different times, depending on where I break down, depending on where I get gas. I'm an equal citizen or I'm not. You know, Pennsylvania has the distinction of being the state that has the most municipal non-discrimination clauses that are LGBT inclusive in the whole country. But the red herring is that by now, any other state that had tried as hard as we have to protect its citizens at the municipal level has been able to do it at the statewide level, something that we've not been able to do in large part, if not almost exclusively, because of how gerrymandered our state legislature is.
Let me quote Garth Everett. He's the chair of the House State Government Committee. This is an email that he sent out last week having to do with this Supreme Court decision. And he said, "We have many other issues in state government to deal with, and we'll have to see where this ranks with those issues." He says, "It may be that the SCOTUS ruling and state regulations will negate the need for legislative action. Time will tell." Are you saying the same thing, Brian Sims?
I'm not. And in fact, we don't need to wait for time for the second part of that. What we know is that the Pennsylvania Human Relations Act, which grew out of the Ethnic Intimidation Act of the late 50s, protects Pennsylvanians of identified classes in areas of housing, employment, and public accommodations. And while this Supreme Court case might grant us protections now in employment, it doesn't in the other two areas. Similarly, when the Supreme Court ruled that marriage equality was the law of the land, the Pennsylvania General Assembly has still not passed the marriage equality bill that my colleague Steve McCarter and I introduced 8 years ago. You know, I am still legally allowed to get married, as are members of my community, but because the laws here aren't contemporary, it's significantly more complicated, arguably more expensive to do so. And so, no, I think that any minute that we wait in order to recognize the full equality of all people is a minute wasted and a minute wronged. I'm appreciative of Chairman Everett's comments. Frankly, those are significantly better comments than we've received from the chairman in the past, Chairman Darrell Metcalf, who is openly homophobic and openly transphobic. There's a sense of optimism here, but it's not clouded by the sort of dogged resolve that we need to have these things done.
Well, we're talking about a legislature dominated, controlled, frankly, by the Republicans. What options do you and other Democrats, and there are some Republicans on, I would say, your side of this issue, what options do you have then?
There's actually a lot more Republicans that support equality, I think, than most people realize. For a number of years, this was the most co-sponsored bill in the legislature that didn't receive a vote in committee. I am certain that were I to spend time talking to most of my Republican colleagues, I do believe that a majority of Republicans in the House would support the bill. But to your point, we are Republican-controlled. unconstitutionally, if you ask me, because of our gerrymander. And it's really the conservative nature of the Republican leadership that has held this up. But not only are we seeing leadership change, which I hope means that we can also see an approach to equality change, but we're also seeing every single year, despite the overwhelming gerrymander, Democrats in Pennsylvania are electing more and more members to the House of Representatives. And there's over a million more registered Democrats in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania than Republicans. And whether it's because the Supreme Court finally rules that gerrymandering is unconstitutional at the statewide level, or the sheer numbers of Democrats in Pennsylvania electing a majority of Democrats to the General Assembly despite the gerrymander, this is something that is going to change.
Brian Cutler is a new House Speaker as of either yesterday or this morning. Will that change anything, do you think?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I can tell you that that the former speaker that sort of left in scandal, Mike Terzai, was certainly among one of the people that was most responsible for keeping things like LGBT.
Whoops. I think we lost Brian Sims. Let me see if we can get him back. That was mid-sentence. Brian Sims, again, our third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. He is a Democrat in the Pennsylvania House of Representatives, representing the 182nd District here in Philadelphia. He's also a civil rights attorney and LGBTQ activist, the first openly gay member of the Pennsylvania General Assembly. And we were talking about a decision last week by the U.S. Supreme Court, essentially giving protections to people who are based on their gender identity and sexual orientations. They can't be fired from their job. And Brian, do we have you back?
Yeah, my apologies, Marty. I'm calling from the Capitol.
Okay. I don't know what that means telephone-wise, but we're happy to have you back. Do you remember where you left off there?
I was. We were talking about whether or not having Brian Cutler as a new Speaker of the House
right.
would impact the buoyancy, if you will, of LGBT equality legislation. And the former Speaker was very much an enemy of equality. And I hope that our new Speaker both sees that being an enemy of equality was not something that I think time and history will reflect well upon. Mm-hmm. But he also, our new speaker is much younger. And, you know, the data tells us just demographically that regardless of ideology, regardless of political party, that people that fall under the age of now in the mid-50s or so are significantly more likely to support equality. And, you know, my interactions with Brian Cutler up to this point lead me to believe that he does think that I should be a full equal citizen in this state. The question is whether or not he will pursue that professionally and politically.
What is the Pennsylvania Fairness Act all about?
The Pennsylvania Fairness Act is exactly sort of what we were speaking about earlier with the broader spectrum of LGBT equality. Every single state and the federal government protects certain classifications of people from certain types of discrimination. And in Pennsylvania, our Human Relations Act protects you because of your religion, your ethnicity, your national origin, sometimes your gender, and it doesn't protect people because of their sexual orientation and gender identity. And it is that broader spectrum, aside from just employment protections. It's protections in housing. Make sure that you can not be kicked out of a house. And, you know, and across the majority of Pennsylvania right now, LGBTQ people like me can be kicked out of an apartment for being LGBTQ. Mm-hmm. It also includes public accommodations, things like park benches, things like a McDonald's, issues of insurance, issues of academia, university discrimination. Those things all matter dramatically far beyond the employment scope. And so for us here in Pennsylvania, until we pass the Pennsylvania Fairness Act, there's no question that LGBTQ Pennsylvanians are still second class, maybe third class citizens in this state.
Let me just give out the ways that our listeners can join our conversation, radiotimes at whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Let me pick up on something you said earlier. I'm thinking of the Obergefell decision, which legalized same-sex marriage. You're saying in Pennsylvania, while you can get married and you are married, you have to go through various different steps because of the way the law is structured in this state?
Yeah, absolutely. No question about it. We, in refusing to allow the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania to make our laws contemporary to reflect the change in law as evidenced by the Supreme Court decision, we simply just make it more complicated for LGBTQ people. A state attorney that I've ever talked to that deals with issues of LGBTQ families, for example, will talk to you about how much more complicated it is for us to divorce, for example. And you know, I want to say to to my colleagues, by not supporting this law, you're not making us go away. We're already here. You're not making marriage equality go away. It is already the law of the land. You're just making our lives harder. You're just making things harder on our families.
Let me ask you about something that happened back in May. You went on Facebook Live to call out one of your Republican colleagues and, frankly, Republican leadership. This was Andrew Lewis, who apparently had tested positive for COVID-19, but didn't tell the Democrats who served on the same committee, including yourself. You called for his resignation. You called for an investigation, even prosecution. First of all, did anyone that you know of contract COVID-19 from Representative Lewis?
Well, first, to be clear, although it was Representative Lewis that we subsequently learned is at least one of the members that has tested positive, and I want to be clear because we also don't know how many members tested positive. It wasn't Representative Lewis whose resignation I think was appropriate. It was the Speaker of the House, and he has since resigned. Representative Lewis is a freshman member of the Republican caucus, and upon determining or finding out that he had tested positive, he did what I believe he was supposed to do, and that was to notify the Republican leadership. From there was what I believe was a completely unethical, if not criminal, breakdown of sort of how coworkers are supposed to approach one another and how a working environment is supposed to approach one another. What we know is that Representative Lewis tested positive on the 20th, but he had taken the test on the 18th.
This is May 20th, right?
Yes, May 18th. And yet there's an incubation period of 2 to 16 days for COVID-19, which meant that based on the timing of his test, that he was potentially infected and infectious for 2 whole weeks that he served on the House floor and served in committee with all of us. Mm-hmm. Now, when he notified the Republican leadership, as best we can tell, and again, because they've answered so few questions, as best we can tell, they picked the last day that he was on the floor of those 14 and notified a couple of Republicans that possibly or likely sat near him, and they quarantined themselves, but they told none of us. What's so egregious about that is that they told none of us in the days before we all went home for Memorial Day. We were 7 days into the potential exposure, halfway through the incubation period of a deadly global pandemic, and the Republican leadership made the decision to not tell us and to let us all go home and see our families. And frankly, they had never made any decision to tell us. We learned through a reporter. I don't know if any of my colleagues have tested positive to this day. Again, we know so little about the Republican, what they said was some degree of an internal investigation. And I think that perhaps makes it even more egregious because it means that a number of them were involved.
The Attorney General, Josh Shapiro, says, while I understand their frustration and concern, a criminal investigation is not warranted based on our initial review. So where do things stand? Is anything going to be different in the Capitol because of this?
You know, there was some sort of general lip service that was paid to whether or not, you know, now I believe it's part of our rules that if anybody tests positive that I don't know if it's a rule or a guideline that we're supposed to notify one another, which seems like basic human decency to me. But no, I can certainly tell you that nothing formally seems to have changed. And the same players that were involved in the original cover-up are now the players that are involved in the sort of new leadership structure. And that doesn't give me a whole lot of hope.
Are people wearing masks in the Capitol?
It's always been a bit of a mixed bag. Democrats here are wearing masks, and we are socially distancing. The Republican caucus, it's been, I'd say about 20% seem to be wearing masks. None of them seem to be socially distancing. But that's to be expected. This is nearly a little over 100 members who have used the entirety of the COVID-19 crisis to argue that it is not a crisis, to argue that because of the particular business in their district is you know, the mainstay of their district, that industry should be able to open up. And, you know, while they were simultaneously arguing that we needed to open up the state, they were testing positive, they were quarantining. In fact, the legislator who had the resolution to end the shutdown couldn't even be here to debate that because he was at home on quarantine.
We have to leave it there. Brian Sims, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Marty, thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. He's a Democrat in the Pennsylvania House of Representatives, representing the 182nd District in Philadelphia. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.